This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed. and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, He named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's president arrives in China for a three-day visit aimed at strengthening economic cooperation between the two countries. The UN chief says Syria's president has agreed to open two more border crossings to let aid into militant-held areas affected by the earthquake. Also coming up, at least three people are killed and five others injured after a gunman opened fire on a university campus in the U.S. state of Michigan. Our top story this hour: Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi is in China for a state visit aimed at building up bilateral ties. Raisi was welcomed by the Chinese Minister of Culture and Tourism upon arrival at Beijing International Airport. The Iranian president will be receiving an official welcome by his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in a few hours' time. Iran and China are set to sign 20 cooperation documents during the visit. Before his departure, Raisi said that Tehran and Beijing share the same stance when it comes to countering unilateralism.
Both Iran and China are opposed to unilateralism and support political independence around the world. This shared stance has brought the two countries close enough that they can have good political and economic cooperation at regional and international levels.
Raisi said he would focus on the implementation of the 25-year strategic cooperation agreement signed with China 2 years ago. He said Tehran and Beijing already enjoy close relations, but there's still much room for expanding cooperation in different sectors, including trade and economy. The president said Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has paved the way for closer ties with China. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed in depth the significance of the Iranian president's visit to China. Let's see what our guests had to say.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Tehran, Fuad Izzadi, academic and political analyst, and out of Kitchener, Ontario, Robert Fatina, author and journalist. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Tehran with Mr. Izzadi. Your perspective on the significance of this trip at this time.
You know, we are moving towards a multipolar world. China, it seems, is going to be one of the poles in the New World Order. Iran has the potential to be a pole in the New World Order. And the cooperation of these countries, countries that are resisting U.S. Hegemony, is quite important. It's beneficial for both sides. Iran is obviously under heavy sanctions from the United States, so having a close economic linkage with China is going to be good for Iran. And China is heavily dependent on energy resources of the Persian Gulf. And Iran is the only country that its foreign policy is not dictated from Washington. Other countries in this part of the world are heavily influenced by the United States. That's something that Chinese leaders understand. And so it's beneficial for them to make sure that they have good relations with Iran. It's a win-win situation, and I think in the next 3 days we will see the benefits of this cooperation presented to the public and to the international observers.
Well, Robert Fatina, your take, it almost appears as if the United States is forcing more and more alliances because of the unilateral policies that it has, the sanctions, and all-out pressure on so many countries. Your assessment of the United States' moves that perhaps actually encourages and forces many of these type alliances?
Yes, certainly. Things like the sanctions against Iran, the aggressive rhetoric against China, have the opposite effect of what the United States wants them to have. When the United States sanctioned Iran, it hoped that the Iranian government would come back to the bargaining table. That didn't happen. Instead, Iran went elsewhere, in this case to China, to establish alliances. They'll be military, they'll be economical. They will be things that will benefit the people of Iran, which is what the Iranian government should do. So the U.S. is, in wanting to ostracize different countries, it's causing them to join together into alliances, which will help them become more powerful, will become more of a check to the United States, which is a very good thing, because the United States for so many decades has just operated around the world in a very destructive and very negative manner. It's estimated to have killed at least 20 million people since the end of World War II. And Iran and China, with their growing alliances, can act as a check to that, because the U.S. may be a little less willing to engage in some military misadventures anywhere in the world, knowing that it will be opposed to by this powerful new union. So the United States government, as usual, is not doing anything that benefits its own people or the people of the world. In fact, it acts to their detriment on a regular basis.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this news review. Fuad Ezzedi, the academic and political analyst out of Tehran, Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Ontario.
Moving on, a week after a powerful earthquake struck Syria and Turkey, the two countries are still overwhelmed by grief, but it is punctuated by rare moments of joy as rescuers pull out people alive from the rubble of collapsed buildings. In one of the latest such moments, a 10-year-old girl was rescued in Turkey's Kahramanmaraş province. There were similar heartwarming scenes in Hatay and Adıyaman provinces. Hopes, however, of finding many more survivors are quickly fading in cold temperatures. Such expectations are even lower across the border in war-torn Syria, which lacks the rescue and relief equipment. In the city of Aleppo, the UNAID chief said the rescue phase was now coming to a close. The focus will switch to shelter, food, and schooling. The death toll from the 7.8 magnitude quake last Monday and the massive tremor just hours later now stands at above 37,000. Nearly 32,000 of the fatalities are confirmed in Turkey alone. Our Istanbul correspondent Rashan Saglam says there could be more people alive under the rubble, despite the hope for finding them are fading away 7 days after the catastrophe.
actually miracles are still happening, especially in the city of Adiyaman or the province of Adiyaman. And a man and his son were rescued after 177 hours. A four-year-old boy was rescued after 178 hours. Also after 177 hours, a young man, 35 years old, in Adiyaman was rescued. And in Antakya, a woman was rescued after 177 hours. So miracles are still happening. And the Turkish rescue teams are still continuing to search for people alive under the debris. They still have hope, especially with this weather. It is easier with the cold weather for people to stay alive more under the debris. Usually it is 7 days after an earthquake happens, but in hotter areas or hotter weathers. Now, due to the cold weather and sometimes due to the snow and rain, people under the debris, in a way or another, are finding it easier to breathe, to stay alive. And some of them said that they were drinking from the water coming inside to under the debris, to them under the debris, from the snow that was falling. So this is a miracle coming from God.
Meanwhile, the UN chief says Syria has agreed to open two more border crossings to allow in aid into militant-held areas affected by last week's devastating earthquake. Antonio Guterres says the crossings will allow more and faster aid delivery from Turkey into northwestern Syria. Previously, the Bab al-Hawa crossing was the only conduit for the delivery of humanitarian aid into the region. Syria is concerned that the border crossings are used to supply Western arms to terrorists. On Monday, the UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting on the humanitarian situation in Syria following the quake. This is what the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations had to say to the reporters following the meeting.
During today's meeting, I conveyed to the Council that the Syrian government has repeatedly expressed its commitment to deliver humanitarian aid to Syrians, whatever they are on the Syrian soil. And I also affirmed that Northwest Syria is an integral part of Syrian lands, and that our people there are part of the Syrian people. And Syria will not accept that they be divided based on lines drawn by terrorist armed groups. Based on that, Syria supports the entry of humanitarian aid into the region through all possible cross points, whatever from inside Syria or across the borders, for the period of 3 months.
Earlier, the UN also warned that terrorists in control of northern Syria are hampering the delivery of aid by Damascus. More than 4 million people live under occupation in militant-controlled areas of northwestern Syria. More Israeli bloodshed in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces have killed 22-year-old Amir al-Bustami during a pre-dawn raid in Nablus. Troopers also injured 6 Palestinians during the raid. In reaction, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said Israeli hostilities are doomed to failure thanks to the heroic resistance of Palestinians. Israel has stepped up its deadly crackdown against Palestinians, killing around 50 people in the occupied West Bank so far this year. Meantime, the regime's forces have demolished a house in East Al-Quds, claiming it lacked a construction permit. The family who owned the house says they were not able to even get the permit.
I We have no criminal record. We have left no way to make ends meet. They did not grant us any permit, construction permits. We want to live. I live amidst an earthquake. There is an earthquake in Al-Quds today. Wasn't there an earthquake in Turkey? And everyone sympathized with the survivors. There is also an earthquake in Al-Quds today. The face of the occupation is the face of mafia, racism, murder and criminality.
Israel regularly raises homes of Palestinians in the occupied territories under different pretexts, including the lack of permits. A report by the UN says those permits are virtually impossible to obtain. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime reported two separate stabbing attacks involving two Palestinian teenagers. A 13-year-old allegedly fatally stabbed an Israeli policeman in the Shafat refugee camp in East Al-Quds. That's hours after a 14-year-old Palestinian slightly injured a young Israeli settler in the old city area of Al-Quds. Israeli police say they have detained both attackers. UN experts are calling on the international community to stop Israel's systematic demolition of Palestinian homes and construction of settlements in the occupied West Bank. The experts said Israel should be held to account for the acts of, quote, domicide. They added that the regime's direct attacks on Palestinian homes, schools, livelihoods, and water sources is now threatening the very existence, their very existence, that is, of the Palestinians. The UN experts also expressed regret that Israel is committing human rights violations and potential war crimes with impunity. In January alone, the regime reportedly demolished over 130 Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank. This figure represents a 135% increase compared to the same period in 2022. This as the regime has been facilitating the expansion of settlements which are illegal under international law. Moving on, Bahrain's top cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim says the anniversary marking the country's 2011 uprising is an occasion to spread the message of unity. The cleric said the Bahraini people need to amplify their efforts for change. He blasted the Al Khalifa regime for marginalizing the people. He also denounced the violation of the rights of political opponents and other dissenting voices held in Bahraini jails. He said some of those being freed from the prisons are either physically disabled or mentally tortured. Sheikh Qasim was addressing the Bahraini nation on the eve of the popular uprising that began in the kingdom on February 14, 2011. People in Bahrain have taken to the streets on a regular basis to demand social equality and the end of the monarchy. The Manama regime, however, responded to the demands with an iron fist, clamping down on any form of dissent. Turning elsewhere, at least three people are confirmed dead in yet another incident of gun violence in the United States. Five others have been hospitalized after the shooting at Michigan State University. Some of them are in life-threatening condition. The incident saw a gunman open fire at several sites inside the campus. He later shot himself dead. The university attack came nearly 14 months after a teenager killed four people at a high school in Oxford, Michigan. The U.S. has seen a surge in gun violence over the past years. Such incidents have killed 25 people since the beginning of this year. That brings an end to International Bulletin for this hour.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Leaders meeting with entrepreneurs and manufacturers. On Monday, 30th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of top business people, manufacturers, employers and industrialists at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. At the beginning of this meeting, top businessmen, manufacturers, knowledge-based entrepreneurs and industrialists presented a report about their activities, their successes, achievements, concerns and worries, making suggestions on how to improve business conditions and the economy, and removing obstacles in the way of business and manufacturing. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Monday, 30th of January 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of top business people, manufacturers, employers, industrialists, and knowledge-based entrepreneurs. After hearing the comments and suggestions made by top businessmen and industrialists, Ayatollah Khamenei thanked and welcomed the audience, saying, "I found your comments and suggestions very interesting and have benefited from your presentation and comments. Clearly, your spirits are very good, you have high hopes, and your endeavors benefit this country." Of course, this does not surprise me. We have highly skilled and talented young people, researchers, business people, entrepreneurs, and industrialists. It is clear to me that there is huge talent in this country. In addition, we are an exceptional nation in terms of God-given natural resources, and we have a geostrategic country, exceptionally well-placed geographically, and we have excellent human resources as well. The leader poignantly added, "What I see in my mind, in my mental vision about the future of this country and the future of this nation, and about the advances that we have been making in science and technology, is a lot more than what is conventionally expressed or assumed. It is truly a lot more." The leader emphasized that relatively good progress has been made in manufacturing, knowledge-based production, job creation, and high-tech industry, stressing that economic growth and manufacturing growth has been significant. Turning to official statistics, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "In the first half of the current Iranian year, we have had some improvements in economic indicators. These indicators were compared to the first half of last year. They show some growth and movement. The increase or growth in non-oil gross domestic product or GDP, growth in the added value of industry and mining sector, especially in the production of large workshops, we had a respectable growth of 6.6%. We also had growth of fixed capital formation and the like. All these point to economic progress." The leader emphasized that the country needs rapid economic growth in order to combat poverty and to raise the living standards of ordinary people. Turning to setbacks and relative standstill in economic activities in the 2010s decade, the leader said, "There are various reasons for this." He added, "Not all of this can be attributed to weak management. No, some of it was related to external factors and some of it related to internal factors. The sanctions had an impact. The reduction in oil prices for a time had certainly an effect. And the fact that the country was focused on the nuclear issue and the economy was dependent on that also had an impact. As a result, we're currently behind, and there are many negative indicators showing this." The leader pointedly added, "Compensating for these setbacks, for falling behind, is obviously not an easy task. It requires sustained medium-term economic growth, if not long-term growth. Certainly, we need 7, 8, or 10 years of sustained economic growth to recover. This is why in the 7th development plan, we have set our main priority in the program to be economic advancement along with justice. The issue of justice is also very important. That is, If we move forward without justice, it is like we have made no progress at all. Progress must be accompanied by justice. Of course, there are certain procedures that must be followed, but it is not something that is impossible or problematic. There are ways to achieve this. In further comments, the leader said, "We have set a target economic growth rate of 8% in the policies of the 7th Development Plan. If we can truly achieve an average growth rate of 8% during the 5-year period of the plan, I think we will have done very well. We need this economic growth. But why? There are basically 4 reasons why we must achieve economic growth. The first reason is that people in the country obviously have problems with the cost of living and the well-being of families. This cannot be overcome in the absence of economic growth. If we want to eliminate poverty, economic growth is needed. This is the government's responsibility. This is the responsibility of capable people, those who have intellectual, financial, or managerial capabilities. Everyone has a responsibility in getting this done. And this is the first reason. The second reason is that Iran's ranking or status must be raised in regional and world economy. Doing this largely depends on the state of the economy. When a country's currency becomes weakened and its economy slumps, its credibility in today's world drops. To protect the country's position and ranking in the world economy, we need economic growth. And this is the second reason. The third reason is that we have many professionals among our human resources. Fortunately, one of the things we take pride in and one of the advantages we have is that we have a large professional, well-trained, highly skilled workforce in the country. Well, we had, for example, about 150,000 university students in the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. Now we have millions of university students and millions of university graduates in an array of scientific disciplines. These people need jobs and employment. We must provide them with employment and careers, and this is the third reason. The fourth reason is that we have a large number of young people in our country today. But will we have the same number of young people tomorrow? It is hard to say. With the situation I'm seeing today, despite all the emphasis that I have made on this point, the results are not very promising. We may not have huge numbers of young people tomorrow. We must make the country wealthy for that day. If the country is not wealthy when the number of young people starts to drop off, it would be hard to manage the economy. And this is the fourth reason why we should focus on bringing about economic growth today. The country needs to become wealthy so that it can manage itself in the future. In further remarks, the leader asks, "So how should we achieve this economic growth? There are 2 main pillars here. The first one is increasing funding for production and manufacturing. This investment in production and manufacturing is very important. The second issue is improving productivity. Our situation is not good in terms of productivity, especially in some areas. Productivity is very low. Work is done, resources are used, but productivity is poor. There are also other requirements. I have written down a few of them, which I will mention very briefly. First of all, the executive bodies of the government that are responsible for economic issues, both the country's general economy and various economic sectors, must have a strategic outlook. They need to have a long-term plan. Of course, I usually ask the government officials about this, and they state that they do have a long-term plan. Well, if a long-term plan, a vision, and a strategic plan exists, we will not suffer from routineness. This routineness causes harm everywhere. We state something one day, and the next day we violate it or change it in some other way. This is exactly what these gentlemen are complaining about. Many of these gentlemen who are active in business and industry are critical of this. Secondly, executive bodies of the government must support the development of private enterprises, the private sector. The country cannot manage without the activities of the private sector. An important mistake that took place in the first years of the revolution, and the effects of it still remain to a large extent, was that they pushed the private sector aside and entrusted everything, even the sale of retail goods, for example, to officials, the government and government organizations. But this was a big mistake. Private enterprises, which is where the presence, ability, initiative and money of the people are, must be supported. They need to be in the middle of the field. They're the ones who should manage the economy. I have repeatedly used the following example. There are two ways you can work. You can put a load in a pickup truck, sit behind the wheel of the pickup truck and easily transfer this load from one place to another. Or you can abandon the pickup truck, carry the load on your shoulders, get tired and not reach your destination. The private sector cannot enter the field if it has no support from the government. And if it does not enter the field in this way, it will not succeed. The third thing that is needed is that our knowledge and technology must improve. The amount of success we have experienced today is due to the country's scientific progress, which, thank God, began 15 or 16 years ago. There has been good progress and improvements have been made. The next point relates to small and medium-sized enterprises, which I emphasized a few years ago in my New Year's speech. These small and medium-sized companies have a great role in creating jobs and added value for goods, and they can be of help to the economy. We must definitely not ignore them. Both government organizations should pay attention to them, and large companies should cooperate with them in their chain of production. They should develop them and help them to thrive. The last issue is the issue of cooperatives. Cooperatives for production can be one of the best ways for creating jobs, especially for creating economic justice in the country. We hope, God willing, the Almighty God will grant success to all of you and to government officials. I witness and testify that the honourable government officials are working with all their strength. I mean, the effort being made is truly very good. However, we should be careful about the direction that they are taking. And, God willing, we should get favourable results.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. For most British citizens, their primary source of information about Israel and Palestine is from TV news bulletins. But academic studies have found a long-standing pro-Israel bias within the UK's broadcast media, resulting in a distorted version of reality being disseminated to the public. And the BBC, Britain's state broadcaster, is one of the worst offenders. So in today's programme, we're going to unpick the BBC's favourable predisposition towards the Zionist regime. I'll be asking two distinguished commentators for their views on this BBC bias after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
The BBC has been attacked by Zionists for its coverage of Palestine for many years. Recently, there has been a campaign to intimidate the BBC into backtracking on a report on a disturbance in London in December 2021. A bus of Jewish young people visited Oxford Street to celebrate Hanukkah, dancing beside a large menorah installed by the Orthodox Chabad Lubavitch sect. A confrontation developed with passing young Muslims during which anti-Israel slogans were voiced. The Board of Deputies claimed it as an anti-Semitic incident. The BBC led on that angle, but also reported anti-Muslim racial slurs were heard. In response, the Board of Deputies commissioned two companies and an academic expert to do the forensic analysis of the recording. Both claimed that the phrase dirty Muslims was not used, but that a Hebrew phrase calling for help was heard. The companies were D3 Forensics, a forensics company, and DigFind. Both are based in Hong Kong and seem to be one-man bands. The first has a minor web presence and a Twitter account with two followers. The second is an anonymous Twitter account and minor website. The director is on LinkedIn under the anonymous handle Mr. DigFind. His recent exploits include claiming that the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was admittedly killed by the occupation forces, was likely killed by a Palestinian bullet. The academic retained by the Board of Deputies was Australia-based Gilad Zuckerman. He has direct interests in the Zionist entity as visiting professor at the Weizmann Institute of Science. He has held a string of appointments at the universities in occupied Palestine. Zuckerman claims, "I'm not aware of any conflict of interest." And as if to cover himself, states, "I have no idea who these people are." In fact, Professor Zuckerman does have a conflict of interest. While at Oxford University, he was, in 1996 to 1998, the president of the Lachaim Society. The Lachaim Society was a part of the global Chabad Lubavitch movement. The bus at Oxford Street was from the Chabad Israeli Center Golders Green, one of more than 30 offices in London. Chabad members from occupied Palestine were on the bus. What is Chabad? It's a deeply racist Jewish supremacist organization. Its key theological tome, the Tanya, makes plain that the sect regards non-Jews as having animal souls. It has many followers amongst the most radical elements of the settler movement, the Hilltop Youth. Its leader there published the King's Torah, which declares killing Palestinian children is permissible since they may grow up to challenge the occupation. Even the Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, states that the rabbi's followers are responsible for most price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians, including murders. Did the kids on the bus condemn dirty Muslims? It would not be a surprise. This is the pedigree of the Hanukkah trip to Oxford Street and the Board of Deputies' laughable defence of it.
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Jackie Walker. Jackie is a political activist and a writer. She's the author of a family memoir, Pilgrim State, and the co-writer and performer of a one-woman show, The Lynching. She also has been a teacher and anti-racism trainer and was formerly the vice chair of Momentum. She's joining us today via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, what can you tell us about the Board of Deputies investigation? I mean, you know the person behind it, don't you?
I do, yes. I mean, the person who commissioned these reports was a guy called Adam Mannett, and he used to work for Corporate Europe Observatory, which is an anti-corporate think tank in Brussels, and I know the people there quite well. I met Adam some years ago, and now he's working for the Board of Deputies as a lobbyist and in public affairs, and he's commissioning these, quite frankly, ridiculous reports from organisations which are said by the Board of Deputies to be highly reputable. Well, if reputable means that people have heard of them, they're not, because one of them's got 2 Twitter followers. I mean, it's incredible. The other one is a troll, a Zionist troll, followed by all the key Zionist trolls in this country. And so what you see here is an obvious propaganda ploy, which they've not even managed to cover up very well.
Yes, indeed. And interesting that the corporate media never take the Board of Deputies to task for those sorts of things. But Jackie, I mean, there was a huge outcry, wasn't there, over this Oxford Street incident. I mean, what was your impression of the mainstream media coverage in general and the BBC in particular?
Well, what was extraordinary in my mind about the way that it was covered was the turnaround that happened. And, I, for example, didn't know until you showed your film just now that what had happened is that those group of Orthodox Jews had been actually dancing and singing in the street. Now, actually, that kind of changes your perception on what it was, because what we were told in the mainstream media was that this is just a group of Jewish young people going on a Hanukkah visit to do some shopping. So it seemed much more random, the whole thing. And that tells you something about the way it's always framed.
Yeah. I mean, David, you were just talking about the bona fides of these companies, that these reputable firms that the Board of Deputies recruited. I mean, can it really be true that they're one-man bands?
Well, one of them, the troll who runs an anonymous troll account and who is on LinkedIn, the business networking website, as Mr. Digfind. He's anonymous on his own LinkedIn profile. I mean, he's the one-man band who recently said that Shireen Abu Akleh was killed probably by a Palestinian bullet. Well, the Israelis have already admitted that it was an IDF bullet which killed her. And the other company, which has this rather amateurish website, is run by one guy, according to our business directories. And there's another directory which says there may be another person who works there. It's not clear if they're the same person or not. So these are not reputable businesses. These are one-man bands. Who knows why on earth the Board of Deputies retained them to do the research. The research in itself isn't very controversial. All they do really is to say, yes, there's a video of this alleged incident, and it's genuine. The video is genuine. Well, no one's questioned the validity and genuineness of the video. The question is whether there is a Hebrew phrase in there saying, please get help, instead of the phrase which the BBC, which checked with 7 different journalists, heard, which was dirty Muslims.
I mean, does it suggest then that there's probably nobody else that they could find to actually do this sort of research for them, because it's bogus?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I don't think we know that, but I mean, it's like an incredible mess that they've made of this. They're trying to do some propaganda here to bully the BBC, which has been very, very effective. Mm. You know, when you actually look at it, it doesn't bear any scrutiny at all. I didn't know this until I had a little look, and all of a sudden the whole thing fell apart in front of me.
Incredible. Well, Jackie, tell us something about how the Board of Deputies actually operates.
Well, I was just going to kind of have a lead-on comment about that, really, because the reason they're effective is not because they've got evidence or use effective researchers or even tell the truth. The reason that the organisations like the Board of Deputies are actually effective is because they are never properly challenged. What they say is not challenged, and they go under this bogus sort of apparel of being a religious group. So people think they're like, I don't know, the Church of England or the Vatican or something like that, and then they're actually not. You know, they're basically a Zionist lobby group.
Sure. Doesn't that kind of undermine, really, the legitimacy of the Board of Deputies, do you think?
Yes, of course it does. But, it doesn't matter, because if they're doing the work that the establishment want them to do, they're not going to be questioned on it. So they're put on the BBC as the spokespeople for Jews. And even if you look at their membership and compare it with the population of Jews, it's obvious that they are not spokespeople for Jews in this country.
Sure. Well, David, I mean, we've discussed the extremist Chabad sect on this show before, haven't we? I mean, what's the connection here? And do you think it's significant?
Well, we have discussed Chabad, and as the film there showed, this is a really quite extreme sect, which is behind, as Chin Bet, the Zionist intelligence agency, says, most of the revenge attacks on Palestinians, including burning people's houses, killing people, actual murders. And yet this is an organization which is all around the world. It's kind of a messianic organization which tries to recruit people, from other parts of Judaism, but also from beyond the Jewish religion. But yet it's never regarded as being in any way extremist. But even their basic theological doctrine, if you look at it, I mean, it's hair-raising. It talks about the fact that non-Jews have souls which are not like human, which are not human souls, they're animal souls. And the King's Torah, which is written by the rabbi who leads them in the hilltop in the settlements, talks about the permissibility, in fact, the fact that it's a good thing to kill Palestinian children. It's truly extraordinary. And this is an organization which sent this bus to London, which has 30 offices in London alone and almost 100 in the UK as a whole. It's an organization which has had no pushback, no proper coverage, no coverage at all, really, in the British press.
Right. Well, I think we'll just then move now to the next section, because we've got another report about how the BBC's systematically preferring to, as it were, put forward Israeli talking points.
All the scientific research on how the BBC deals with Zionism and Palestine shows that it's endemically biased against the Palestinians. The most comprehensive study showed a systematic preference for Israeli points of view. Israeli casualties were disproportionately reported. But this does not stop the Zionists pretending that the corporation is anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. The reporting of the events in Oxford Street in December 2021 is a key example. The Ofcom report on the incident was jumped on by the Jewish Chronicle, saying it slammed the BBC. The verdict was a victory for the JC. But it was no such thing. There was no claim that the BBC was wrong to report on the alleged racial slur, simply that it should have included the alternative views sooner once they emerged. Amongst other recent attacks have been claims of Jew hatred in the BBC Arabic service. It's not well known, but BBC Arabic has always been a propaganda service run directly in government interest. In fact, from the beginning in the 1930s, discussions between the Foreign Office and the BBC led to the omission of news which, in the view of the Foreign Office, would be inadvisable in times of crisis. This non-written agreement prevailed in the following six decades and is still valid up to the present day. It was the Foreign Office that directly funded a BBC Arabic TV service to compete with Al Jazeera from 2008. When Foreign Office cuts resulted in a planned secession, the FCO stepped in specifically to save the Arabic service in 2014. The campaign against the BBC is being led by the Jewish Chronicle, a paper with a decades-long history of ideological prejudice towards Muslims and a recent catalogue of defamatory stories. In 2020, there was a messy takeover battle won by a hardline Zionist consortium. It's led by Sir Robbie Gibb, who is now the sole owner of the company. Gibb has a history of working directly at the behest of Western intelligence agencies in subversion in the former Soviet Union. This was through a CIA and MI6-backed group called the Alliance of Russian Solidaritists. He worked for the BBC for a number of years and then was spokesperson for Theresa May from 2017 when she was Prime Minister. In April 2021, it was reported Gibb would join the BBC Board of Governors. In August 2022, former BBC presenter Emily Maitlis stated that Gibb, an active agent of the Conservative Party, played a significant role in determining the nature of the corporation's news output. Gibb reportedly raised concerns about the BBC's reporting on the Oxford Street incident. His role in supporting, perhaps directing a campaign against the BBC is a flagrant conflict of interest.
David, in my opening remarks, I referred to academic research showing that the broadcast media bias results in kind of long-standing misreporting of Palestine. I mean, tell us about the research basis for that.
Well, I mean, the biggest studies were ones done at Glasgow University, where I used to work, at the Glasgow University Media Group, by Greg Philo and his colleagues there. And they show, as does almost all research which has been done, and certainly all legitimate research which has been done in this area, shows that, it's Zionist talking points, Zionist frames of reference, which are used on the BBC and by other broadcasters, including ITV and ITN in the UK, and that they give much more explanation to Israeli points of view than they do to the Palestinians. They give more time to the Israelis than they do to the Palestinians. They don't explain why things happen in the territories and in occupation. So it's well known that the BBC and other broadcasters are biased systematically against the Palestinians. But, of course, that doesn't detain the Zionists, who nevertheless complain about rising trends of Jew hatred in the media and all this kind of thing, which is, you know, it's palpable nonsense.
Mm. I mean, Jackie, the BBC's Panorama programme about alleged anti-Semitism in the Labour Party contrasted sharply with Al Jazeera's Labour files, didn't it?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, let's face it, the Panorama programme was a total travesty. From the way that it was edited, to the script that it ran through, to the people who were interviewed, who all came from one group, the Zionist Jewish Labour Movement. In fact, they didn't just come from one group. They were all from the executive, basically, of one group. Now, how do you call that a documentary? I mean, it's just pretty awful, really. And what's interesting about Al Jazeera is the fact that although that program was terribly undermined and ignored at the same time in the British media, we know that elsewhere it's actually very well respected. What we have here is a very vigorous propaganda war going.
Yeah. I mean, David, is it true that BBC Arabic has always been an instrument of the British Foreign Office?
It has. I mean, the BBC itself as an institution has had a close relationship historically with the British government. But BBC Arabic, specifically, it was always regarded as being just an arm of external propaganda by the Foreign Office. And that was the deal which they came to with the BBC in order that they would fund it directly. And when they stopped funding it in the 2000s, then the government made sure that an extra subvention was given because the Arabic service was regarded as being really very important for British propaganda purposes. So yes, of course, that's always been the case. And so then the idea that there are somehow anti-Israel sentiments being expressed in the BBC Arabic is just preposterous. But of course, that doesn't stop the coverage and the use of BBC Arabic as part of the attack on the BBC, which is being led by the JC.
No, indeed. Well, Jackie, tell us a little about the way the BBC covered Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party.
Well, I'll just give you one example, and it's probably the one of the best known ones, which was that awful interview about Corbyn, which had the backdrop of him with the Kremlin in the back. But in actual fact, it wasn't even just that. It was this mixture of both ignoring evidence, ignoring facts, ignoring alternative points of view, but also having some of the worst protagonists on and giving them an unchallenged, not just in terms of them being asked questions, but the airtime. I mean, it almost seemed at one point that we had everyday non-stop comments, for example, from Elman. It got so bad, I just turned BBC off because it was terrible, and I'm sure you remember that as well. It was incessant.
Yes.
The interesting thing is that now, you must know this story, that recently a Holocaust survivor has actually been constructively forced out of the Labour Party for actually trying to speak on Holocaust Memorial Day and nobody in the media is interested in it.
No, indeed. Indeed. Well, David, I mean, Robbie Gibbs' apparent involvement with MI6 is an interesting story, isn't it? I mean, tell us something about that. It's a rather bizarre episode, isn't it?
Well, this organisation, the National Alliance of Russian Solidarists, was a front group which was used... it was a right-wing Russian nationalist organisation which was used by the CIA and indeed by MI6 back in the day. And they sent people in the early 80s. Robbie Gibb went, his brother Nick Gibb went, Julian Lewis, the chair of the Select Committee on Intelligence, was involved as well. And they went over there. In the 60s, MI6 was directly involved in it. But then MI6 withdrew from the project after they were exposed by Soviet intelligence. They realised they'd been burned. It looks like the MI6 probably got back involved later on, but we don't know that for a fact. It certainly was involved, a project which the CIA was directing for many, many years. So we don't really know if it was MI6 he was working for, or